do not bring us up from here. Don't bring us up from here. And then he tells why that's important, because it says, for how shall it be known that I have found favor in your sight, I and your people? Is it not your going with us so that we are distinct, I and your people, from every other people on the face of the earth? So this, the direct, distinct presence of Yahweh, God with them, was what separated them from every other people on all of the earth. That was very much a distinction for them. And so Moses appeals to God, saying, please go with us. We're going to get God's response, but I want to get the other request first. The next request Moses makes is Moses asks God to see his glory. He asks to see the glory of God. It's found in verse 18. Moses says, please show me your glory. So that's the second request. And I don't know necessarily what pushed Moses to ask for that. He asked for God's presence, and then God actually, in this first part of the response, God says, I will go with you. Because you are special to me, because you're important to me, because of who you are. You have found favor in my sight. I know you by name. And he says, I will go with you. And then immediately after that, Moses says to God, show me your glory. And what I find pretty interesting here is that no matter why the request was made, and we don't know, I've tried to figure out, okay, so why is this so important with Moses regarding the glory of God here? Why did he need to say it? I mean, he had seen amazing stuff from God, right? He had seen God in the burning bush. He had watched God do amazing stuff in Egypt. He had seen God do incredible stuff already just on the way from Egypt to Sinai. He'd seen the Red Sea part just by Moses raising his staff. He had seen bitter water turned sweet. He had seen manna and quail provided. He had seen a miraculous provision of water when there was nothing, when there was no water. He had seen over and over and over again just great things of God. He had spent the last 40 days on a mountain and hearing God speak to him and getting the law from God, getting the dimensions of the tabernacle. He had seen the heavenly tabernacle, which serves as the real tabernacle, the pattern for which the earthly tabernacle was fashioned from. He had seen all of that, and yet he still, as he gets through asking God's presence to go with him, the next thing he asks is he says, and God says, yes, I will go with you. He says, will you show me your glory? And what I really appreciate about God's response wasn't, haven't you seen enough? Isn't that enough for you? It wasn't, let me rehearse everything I've shown you. It wasn't that. It was, well, it's going to be tough because you really can't see my glory and live, but I'll do the best I can. That's basically God's response. And those are my words. Those are my words for what God says, but that's basically what God tells him. Because God says, verse 19, he said, I will make all my goodness pass before you and proclaim before you my name, the Lord. I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious and show mercy on whom I will show mercy. But he says, you cannot see my face. For man shall not see me and live. And the Lord said, behold, there is a place by me where you shall stand in a rock when my glory passes by. But you, I will put you in a cleft of the rock. I will cover you with my hand until I pass by. Then I will take away my hand and you shall see my back, but my face shall not be seen. So God says, here's what we'll do. You can't see me in all of my glory because no man will see me that way and live. And I do find it interesting that if you look at the descriptions, of God, very rarely is the face actually described. Is God's face actually described? You see description of his robe. You description of what he's wearing. You description of even John in Revelation when he turns and sees Jesus. He describes fiery eyes and a mouth a sword. But really, the main description is from basically neck down. It's interesting that if you follow through all the descriptions of people who saw God, what they describe. Even remember the elders go and they see God, but if you look, all they describe are his feet. All they describe are God's feet. That's just an interesting little side note for you. You can take that's free. I won't charge any of you for that. But it just seems interesting to me that if you look at the descriptions, very rarely is his face very well described, because I don't think anybody gets to see it. So that's what he's going to do. And so he answers Moses' request not by saying, haven't you seen enough? He answers by saying, I'll show you as much of me as I can. I'll show as much of me as I can. I think that speaks to the special relationship that God and Moses had. Moses was a special choice of God to be this special leader for his people, and to accomplish this huge thing, this huge task. Really, it is Exodus. It is the book of Exodus, and it is Moses' faithfulness throughout the book of Exodus that really establishes. I know that God's in control of all that. I get that. I understand God's sovereignty. I understand God's providence. I understand God's hand in everything. I get that. But from a human perspective, it is Moses' faithfulness to the calling that God called him to accomplish that, that really led to the establishment of Israel as a nation. And it was a big deal. It was a big deal that Moses was this guy. And I think that God recognized the importance of that. And recognize Moses for that, and that there's this really special relationship that Moses and God have. So God says, I will do as much as I can. I will pass by. I'll put you in a cleft of the rock. I will cover you. When I have passed by completely, I will then take the covering off, and you will see my back. Now, the key question then would be verse 23, what is my back? What is my back or my hind parts, whatever your translation says? And here's what I'll say with 100% confidence. It means my back or my hind parts or the lower part of my glory. I have no clue what it means. Moses doesn't describe any further what it means. So we have no clue exactly what it means. So I'm at this point, I could tell you all of the guesses, but it would just be speculation. What Moses saw was something that was the God's glory that was shown to him in a way that no other person had seen that glory. It was something more significant than a burning bush. It was something more significant than crossing a Red Sea on dry ground. It was something more significant than what Moses had seen on the mountain while he's getting the Ten Commandments, the law the first time. It was something more significant than that. So it was something very special. Hard to describe, but something more significant than what Moses saw face to face with the presence of God at the tent of meeting. It was something more significant than that. And remember, when Moses met with God, his face would glow. That's pretty significant. I believe it's something more significant than that. But what it is, I really don't know. I can't tell you what it is, except to say it was something fairly special. Something fairly special. I think it was something even more special, more significant than what James, John, and Peter saw on the Mount of Transfiguration. Why do I say that? Well, because when James, John, and Peter came down from the Mount of Transfiguration, their faces weren't glowing. So I think it was the closest, I believe, this was the closest that any human being has ever come to seeing God in his full glory. And I think it's just a statement of the special relationship between God and Moses. So that is Moses' request, Moses' prayer, and God's answer. Show your presence goes with us. Show me your glory. God's response is, yes, I will go with you, and yes, I will show you as much of my glory as I can. Okay, that's God's response to his faithful servant. Now God says to Moses, now we're moving on to chapter 34, which is, I believe, the renewal of the covenant, where the covenant is now renewed, because it's been broken, right? The covenant has been broken. The covenant established back in Exodus 25, Dave, did you have your hand? Okay. Mm-hmm. that with us? That's a good. So Dave's not really questioned more of it, but it was more of a statement that this seems to be more than just the omnipresence of God. I actually believe that. Here's what I think was at the root of that. God's presence was now dwelling with Israel as a pillar of cloud or pillar of smoke in the day, fire at night, right? That was his presence, and that had been there since they'd left Egypt. Since they had left Egypt, remember, God's presence went before them as a pillar of cloud or smoke in the day and a pillar of fire at night, which was directing them, showing exactly where to go, and they had been following that. Now when they are at the mountain, at Mount Sinai, where is God's presence? God's presence is on the mountain, right? That's where it is, where Moses goes up and spends time with God. When the tabernacle is finished, which hasn't happened yet in Exodus 33, when the tabernacle is finished, God's presence is going to be there at the tabernacle. It's going to be dwelling on the mercy seat in the Holy of Holies. That's where the presence of God would be visibly seen. And I think that's what's here. I think that what God was telling Moses was, at this point, you guys have broken the covenant. You've broken the covenant. And so what's happening now is, I'll still keep my end of the bargain. I will give you the land I promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I will give you that land. And in fact, I will send my angel before you to make the land accessible, so you can go into that land. I will do that, but my presence, that cloud and fire, that presence is not going to be there. It's not going to be there. It's going to go away. Wow, that seems harsh. But I'll tell you, I think that from the destruction of Solomon's temple until now, that's how it's been. That's how it's been. Has Israel stopped being God's people? Absolutely not. Israel has continued to be God's people. But the presence of God, I better take a hiccup there. I'll go back, and for 33 years, it's been, there's a 33-year gap where God's presence was with his people. But now it's back to the way it was after the destruction of Solomon's temple. It's interesting. When Solomon's temple was destroyed, where did God's presence dwell on earth? Well, remember that in the Old Testament, in a Jewish the law mentality or economy, God did not indwell those who were Jews forever like he does the church. That didn't happen. The Spirit would come alongside somebody for a specific purpose, for a specific time, but that Spirit could be removed. So it's not the same kind of relationship that God had. So we can't say, well, God's presence was then in his people. I don't believe that to be true at all. I think God's presence left when the temple was destroyed, because the it was gone. And it's interesting, if you read, so for 70 years they're in captivity, for 70 years they're gone, and actually it's 90 years after the temple is after the first exportation of Jews in 607 BC, it's 90 years until the temple is completed in Ezra. Zechariah and Haggai are there, but the temple's completed in Ezra, right? And it's in about 516, the temple's completed. At that dedication service, the temple is dedicated, but there's no record of God's presence entering that temple the way it did to Solomon's temple. There's no record of that. There's a dedication ceremony, but there's no record of the presence of God coming in and filling the temple with smoke so that everybody had to leave. If you remember, when Solomon dedicated the temple, that's exactly what happened. And there was a clear transition of God's presence from the tabernacle to the temple. Now, when we get to Habakkuk, what's his name? Zerubbabel's temple, which is the one that's built as they go back to the land. Zerubbabel's temple finished in 516 BC. There was no God's presence at a tabernacle. Tabernacle wasn't being used, and there's no movement of God's presence, at least not that I can find, and not that most biblical scholars can find. There's no movement of God's presence into that temple. When God's presence finally enters that temple is when Jesus shows up, when he's dedicated. That's the next time God's presence enters that temple. And God is with his people there, I think, which is the Emmanuel thing, which is God with us. And I think that's one of the reasons that Emmanuel is a really huge name for him. Because it is God saying to his people, I will be with you again. And he hasn't been with them for 586 years. That's a long time not to be with his people. They didn't stop being his people. They didn't become less of his people. His presence was just not with them. So he comes in about between 4 and 3 BC. He comes and he lives with them for 33 years. God's presence is there. And how do they respond to that presence? They kill him too. So, you know, Israel doesn't do well with God's presence. At least it doesn't seem, because when God is dwelling in the temple, they reject him. When God comes and walks among them as Jesus, they reject him. Which is why Zechariah is really important, because at the time when God appoints, at the end of time, they're going to look on him and they're going to mourn for one they've pierced, and they're going to accept him as their God, and they're going to accept his presence with them, and his presence will be with them again then forever. So that's the presence that I think is talked about. That's the presence. It's that presence that's going to go with him. They wouldn't stop being his people, but there would, because I think the example shows from destruction of Solomon's temple all the way until Jesus comes, they never stop being his people. But actually the physical presence of God being with them was removed, was gone. It doesn't mean that there weren't special men throughout that time period given, you know, with God's presence and dwelling. I think Daniel had to have had some kind of a sense of the presence of God, the Spirit of God working with him. I don't think you can deny that. I don't think Zechariah was making up his prophecy. I don't think he's just making, I think the Spirit of God was speaking to Zechariah as he prophesied. I don't think Haggai is just making stuff up as he goes along. I think Haggai has Spirit of God because of what Peter says about the Scriptures. Peter himself in 2 Peter says, no prophecies of any private interpretation, but holy men of God spoke as they were moved along by the Holy Spirit. They were carried along. That would include, in Peter's mind, that would include Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. And more than likely, Ezra and Nehemiah. And whoever wrote Esther. Because those are all posted, those are all books that were written after the exile. And you could almost include part of Jeremiah and Ezekiel in there, because they're written during the exile. Jeremiah and Ezekiel are written during the exile. So you can see God's Spirit with some of his people, but the presence of God with Israel as a nation really isn't there. And I think you'd be hard-pressed to find it post-Solomon's temple. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find it until Jesus shows up. 33 years he's there again, and now he's gone. Now he's gone. That was a long answer to a short question. But remember, so if we don't make it very far, that was not my fault. I was moving on. I was moving on, and Dave stopped it. But it was a good question. It was really, it's an important question, what the presence of God is and how that works. The presence of God not going with did not mean God was going to abandon his people. It meant God's presence wasn't going to be with them. And it does happen. It does happen. There's an example, I think, there's a couple thousand years now where that's been the case, where God's presence hasn't been with his people, but that doesn't mean he's thrown his people off. They're still his people. At least Paul thought so. So, all right, good. Any other questions before we move forward? Brian. Well, so his statement was, I will send my angel before you, but I will not go with you. Now, we don't know what that would have looked like. The reason we don't know what that would have looked like is because it didn't happen. It didn't happen. It didn't happen, we talked about this last week, it didn't happen because Moses interceded for the people. Remember, God said, go, I'll send my angel, but I'm not going to go with you. And Moses immediately goes before God and intercedes for them. And God responds to Moses' intercession by saying, because I'll use his words. He says, the Lord said to Moses, this very thing that you have spoken I will do, for you have found favor in my sight, and I know you by name. And so God then says to Moses, I will go with you. My presence will be with you. He actually said that up in verse 14. He says, and he said, my presence will go with you, and I will give you rest. And then Moses, just to nail him down a little bit more, just to make it more solid, Moses said, God said, my presence will go with all your rest. And Moses says, okay, if you will not go with us, then don't send us. That's how important this is. And so God says, I'm going to go with you. I'm going to go with you, and I'm going to do what this thing is that you said. So we don't know what it would have looked like. We don't know. There would have been somebody guiding them. There would have been somebody, something leading them. The angel of God was going to go before them. God says that. What did that look? I have no clue. Here's why I have no clue. Because it didn't happen. It didn't happen. Because Moses interceded for the people, and God said, I know you by name. You found favor in my sight. I know you by name. I will go with you. So I don't know what it looked like, but there would have been leader. There would have been guidance, but we don't know. I don't know what it would look like. It would not have looked like, I can tell you this, I'm fairly confident and would say this with 92.9%. I don't know. With a great amount, it would not have looked like a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. It would not have looked like that. It would look like something different. Maybe an angel. Maybe, I don't know what it would have looked like, but it would have looked different than what it was. So we just got hijacked completely. Why is that important? Why is that important that God's presence is with them? I mean, you know, I think of, you know, angels like Michael, the archangel. Pretty powerful guy, right? It seems like he could probably do whatever it was he needed to do. It seems like angels always do, except for the fallen angels. It seems like angels always do exactly what it is God says to them. So it's not like if he sends Michael to lead that, and I do think, you know, okay, here I'm giving something away. I think that if it would have been God's presence gone, it would have been Michael leading because he seems to be the guy that takes care of Israel. If you look through the history of angels. But don't do that because God tells us not to do histories of angels. So, but if you were to do that, you would see that Michael kind of is especially over Israel. Because it's Michael who argues with, it's Michael who battles with Satan over the body of Moses. Remember that story in Daniel? That they contend for the body of Moses. Why would that be important? Because Michael's taking care of Israel. Michael is involved with Israel somehow. So I think it may have been Michael who would have led, and he's powerful. So why is it such a big deal that God's presence goes with him? I think there's two reasons it's a big deal. First reason it's a big deal, it's for the people. As they were wandering, as they were walking, as they were going where they were supposed to go, what always was before them was a pillar of fire and a pillar of cloud. They were always recognizing God is with us. When you're back, and they didn't as a whole do a really good job of understanding that, but I think there were probably some in the group who said, you know, God is with us. And because God is with us, we will go His way. I think there was security and assurance in the fact that they saw God's presence with them. It was a visible, clear, not just some kind of good feeling on the inside. That's not what it was. It wasn't just, well, we can feel good about God's presence because we feel Him inside. We have this feeling, this unction, if you will. That's not what it was. It wasn't some kind of unction. It was physical, visible presence of God in the form of a pillar of cloud, in the form of a pillar of fire. That's what the physical, and I think it served as assurance and security, and in some sense, a cause for fear for them. Not a great cause for fear because they really mess up a lot, but it was a cause for fear. So I think that's one reason. Second reason is for those nations around. Those nations, and that's really one of the things that Moses brings to God. How will the nations know? How will anybody know we're special if you're not with us? I mean, you think about it. Which is going to create more of a stir around the nations as this 2 million people group is walking through the wilderness coming toward your land, and they're just a group of 2 million people coming toward your land? Wow, that's a lot of people. We can do this. But if there's 2 million people coming for your land, and in front of them is this huge pillar of fire and this huge pillar of cloud, you might say, "That's, I've never seen that before. Run!" You know, so I would respond. And I think there was a statement to the nations around that this is a special people. This people has something that no one else has, which is what Moses says, has no one else has, and that is the very presence of their God with them that is going before them to accomplish this thing. It makes a difference, and it is important. It's going to be 40 years later. It's going to be 40 years later, but they are going to eventually get into the land. And what is it? Why is it that Rahab agrees to hide the spies? Because she's heard about Israel and her God. And she's heard that. And they're distinct and they're separate from any other group of people that have come in there. Why? Because God's presence has gone with them. So I think those are the two reasons that the presence of God was really important and not just an angel. Could an angel have done it? Absolutely. I think an angel could have accomplished what God, an angel could have taken them into the land. An angel could have led them into the land. An angel could have accomplished what needed to be accomplished. But for them to be, for themselves to be assured and secure and fearful, they needed the presence of God to go before them, and for the nations around them to recognize this is a special nation unlike any other nation ever before, because not only are they not just carrying their God as a bull or as some kind of an idol, they're not just carrying him around like that. They actually have a presence of God going before them that is a clear, visible presence that's always there. And so I think that's the significance of and the importance of the presence of God going with them. Go ahead, Dave. We're not getting to 34 today. Sorry. Yeah. So Dave said, if you go back to what God says, I'm not going to go with you, because if I go with you, it might just be that I destroy you on the way. And I think it's important to recognize how long the way was supposed to be. Okay. Let's go back and rethink how long the way was supposed to be. They're going to be at Sinai for about a year. They spend a year at Sinai. So it took them about 3 months to get to Sinai. If you do the math, remember, about 3 months to get to Sinai. And they're going to finish that year out there. They're going to celebrate at least one Passover at Sinai before they take off. So this is about a year. It is, according to Deuteronomy, this is like 4 years ago, last time I studied Deuteronomy really in detail. It's 11 days. From Sinai to the land is supposed to be an 11-day journey. Okay? It's not like 24 months. It's not even a year. It's 11 days. So if you think of the significance of that, God is saying to them, if I go with you, this is how angry he is, if I go with you, I might destroy you in 11 days. That's how angry he was. Again, understanding the sovereignty of God and his providence, This didn't catch him off guard. It went, wow, these people are really bad. But from a human perspective, he is so angry at them that he says, if I don't go with you, there's a strong possibility, if I do go with you, there's a strong possibility that I would destroy you in 11 days. Okay, that's not what happens. Yes, he does destroy this generation of the people. But what was, remember what he told Moses he was going to do? What did he told Moses he was going to do? He told Moses, you leave me alone, I'm going to wipe this people out, and I'm going to start over with you. That's the destruction that I think he's talking about. It's a complete wiping out of this people and starting over with Moses. Why do I say that? Because here he did that, he said that. In Numbers 14, he's going to say the exact same thing. And it's when God responds in anger, when his anger is aroused against Israel, his response is, Moses, I'm going to destroy this people, and I'm going to start over with you. I'm going to start over with you. Every time Moses says, no, you can't do that. You can't do that. Remember your name. Remember your name. And I think that's the destruction that God has in mind, is a complete destruction of the people to wipe them off the face of the earth. That's his plan for destruction. That's not what happens to Israel in 40 years of wandering. That is not what happened. In 40 years of wandering, that generation dies out, but there's time in that 40 years of wandering for a new generation to rise up and to be ready to go into the land. So it's not the same kind of destruction being talked about, but what God talks about in Exodus 33, where he says, I might destroy you on the way, and what happens to them in the 40 years of wandering. It's not the same kind of destruction. Because Israel itself is not completely destroyed, and God doesn't start over with Moses. So I think that's the distinction and the difference there about the two types of destruction, if you will. He is going to destroy this generation. This generation is going to die in the wilderness, every one of them, except Joshua and Caleb. Even Moses is going to die before he goes into the land, not because of what happened in Numbers 13. Moses is going to die because of his hitting the rock the second time. That's why Moses is not going to go in to the land. But he's not even going to make it. The only two people from this generation that make it into the land are Joshua and Caleb. So what does the generation mean? Everybody who was 20 years old and up made that generation. Everyone who was 20 years old and older, that whole group of people is going to die in the wilderness before they go in. And that's going to take the 40 years. That's why it's a 40-year wandering in the wilderness. We'll eventually get there when we hit Numbers, like 13. But we may never actually make it there. So I figure I got like 5 years left of life, and then that's it. We're done. So, no, I'm joking. So, any other, those are all three good questions. And I'm glad we did it. Wasn't my plan, but I'm glad we did it. So, any others? Before we try to jump into 34? All right, we're going to try to jump into 34, which I call the renewal of the covenant. Again, as I started off, this covenant has been broken. The people broke the covenant. They had, in Exodus 25, they had said to God, what you've said we will do, we will obey. I guess actually it's 24. Where is it? It's Exodus 24. I don't know why I said 25. That's where the covenant is instituted. So they've said, we'll obey, we'll do what you say, we'll do it. In a really short time, less than 40 days, they have violated it. And so what happens in chapter 34 is, two things specifically. Moses gets new tablets, or makes new tablets, and God renews the covenant with them. So the first part is the new tablets. Remember, at the end of 32, God gives Moses these two tablets, and Moses heads down the mountain, hears the noise, not of war, not of crying, but of partying, and walks around the corner in great Charlton Heston fashion, sees the partying, and he throws the tablets and breaks them. And I believe that's Moses responding in anger. That wasn't God's plan for those tablets to be broken. And I think it's interesting that God gave Moses the tablets the first time, but he doesn't give him the second. He tells Moses, the Lord said to Moses, chapter 34, verse 1, cut for yourself two tablets of stone like the first. So you're going to do some work. I think this is God actually working to mature Moses. This is God working. He knows what he knows. Moses' buttons get pushed by this people. I think he understands that. He understands that Moses responds in anger. And I think he's working with Moses to help Moses not respond in anger. So he makes Moses do some physical labor here in cutting out these stones, cutting out these tablets. So Moses cuts out these two tablets. And he says, and I will write on the tablets the words that were on the first tablets, which you broke. Again, it's not which I told you to break. That's good English. Told you to break. It's not that. It's I'll write the words that were on the first ones that you broke. So he doesn't give him much time. Now, it's interesting, as we get to the end of this chapter, the text is going to tell us that Moses actually wrote on the tablets. So it's interesting. We'll talk about that. There's someone that we've got to talk about. We're going to talk about that. But at the end of chapter 34, it says Moses wrote on all the words on the tablets, and yet God says, I will write. Well, how did God write the Bible? How did God write the Bible? Using the hands of men. I think what's being said here, just, and I'll get there later on, I think what's being said here is God would give the words. Moses did the writing. Moses did the writing. In the first set, God did everything. In this set, God through Moses does it. God through Moses does it, but it's Moses that's going to actually be the one that does that. And we'll get there. But he doesn't give him much time to cut these things out. He says, you cut yourself out two new tablets like the ones I gave you in the first, and be ready to go in the morning. Be ready to go in the morning. So don't dilly. Don't dawdle. What's that word? Why do you say that? Don't linger. I'll just go with linger. I know that's a good word. Don't linger on this. Get busy. Do this because I want you ready in the morning. I want you ready in the morning to go back up on the mountain. So he says, be ready in the morning and come up in the morning to Mount Sinai and present yourself there to me on the top of the mountain. No one shall come up with you. And let no one be seen throughout all the mountain. Let no flocks, no herds graze opposite the mountain. So Moses cut two tablets of stone like the first, and he rose early in the morning and went up on Mount Sinai as the Lord commanded him. So now we have the two new tablets, but they're blank. They're blank. Moses takes them up. He goes up mountain, and the Lord descends in a cloud, and then he makes this statement. And this is where Moses actually, I think, the answer to see the glory, the request to see the glory is actually answered here in this section, because Moses sees and hears something. The Lord descended in a cloud and stood with him there and proclaimed the name of the Lord. The Lord passed before him and proclaimed the Lord a God, merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression of sin, but who will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers and the children and the children's children to the third and fourth generation. Moses quickly bowed his head toward the earth and worshipped. He said, now if I find favor in your sight, O Lord, please let the Lord go in the midst of us, for it is a stiff-necked people, and pardon our iniquity and our sin, and take us for your inheritance. There is a lot that I want to talk about there that I don't have time to talk about in 3 minutes. But I want to spend some time with what God proclaims about himself there. We've seen it before, and we will see it again. But I think right here, it's not missed. It's really important what he says right here, because if you recall, the people have sinned greatly. People have sinned greatly, and what God is going to talk about is his graciousness and his mercy and his faithfulness to those who love him, but his justice and his anger and his visiting of sin to those who don't. I think there's a clear There's a clear statement of God, all of God, in play here, where you see his grace and mercy played against his justice all at once. And I think it's really important that we spend some time there that we aren't going to have time to spend there this morning. So I guess that, what time is it? Yeah, it's close enough for government work. I can say that because I was a government employee, so I'm not only disparaging myself. So so let me pray, and then we'll let you guys go. Lord, thank you for the truth of your word. Again, Lord, thank you that we have the promise of your presence with us and the guarantee of your spirit. Thank you that we don't have to fear you leaving us, that you've pledged yourself to us, that you hold us in your hand, that we are kept in the hand of the Father. Thank you that we have that assurance. Lord, I pray that you would help us to live like it. Help us to be confident in you and your presence. Thank you for your word this morning. I ask this all in your name. Amen. All right, thanks. You did a good job.